Access number 11938, reel 4.
Mr. G. Eyston, Reel 4. We were talking about the motorised role of the division, Mr. Eyston, and you were saying in what way that affected your position when you were in France.
Yes, I think that the division was motorised late 1938. And probably at camp in 39, they had done some motorised. Anything motorised at all was a battalion exercise at Kingham. Well, we did have some RDSC transport, and I think that is the only occasion when, before France, where we had motorised transport other than our own. The reason probably was that the RAC had to get their vehicles and get their drivers, and they had their own training to do. It would probably take them 3 months before they got proficient to do their proper function with the division. I'd better say just here that the boys that we had, the RAC, I can't remember the platoon number now, but they stayed with us till we got to Belgium in any case. I don't remember, well, I don't know anything about them after Belgium because we marched out of Belgium. But they stayed with us and they were very good. They more or less lived with us when we were on the move properly. And the first real motorised exercise was from Fréni to Tourouve. That was a distance of some, 40 miles, something like that, I think. Yeah, 70 kilometres. And this was where I first started leading a convoy with the Major Jeffreys, and we travelled at 18 miles an hour. And I got my fingers wrapped if I got beyond 21 miles an hour. He was very, very strict. He used to watch the speedometer more than I did, I think, because for me, a lad of 19 to travel at 18 miles an hour was not quite on. Eventually, I did get used to it. But this trip to Tourouve, I think, was the first real motorised move the division had done, because they left Kingham by train and they got to Fréni by train because the vehicles had gone over in advance. We had buses, true enough, when we went to Whitburn from Bishop Auckland, but that wasn't motorised exercise, that was a purely a bus effort. So I think that the real first training we got as a motorised unit was from Fréni to Tourouve.
Can we deal for some time on that? Just what form did this training take?
Well, for aircraft purposes, vehicles should be 120 yards apart. That is so that if a plane comes over, he can't tuck his nose down and fire at a stream of traffic. He's got to put his nose down, fire at one, lift up and come down, fire at another. So it's 120 yards apart. But means when the battalion's on the road, it's 120 miles long. So obviously the first vehicle's home and dry before the last one's set off. In the early stages, this was really serious. Because as I said, I was travelling at 18 miles an hour. And I'm told that they used to bunch up towards the back because you lose sight of the vehicle in front, and they would close up and close up and close up until the vehicles at the back were doing 60 miles an hour, which was all wrong. And of course, the MPs, they were divisional MPs, again, which is something new to us. They'd just sort of come on the field as far as we were concerned. We had our own regimental police, but the divisional MPs, they'd just come on the scene. And they were taking numbers and quoting company commanders and all the rest of it for travelling too fast. So eventually it worked out, and we got in the swing of things, you realise that if you lost somebody in the front, you tried to catch up a little bit, but you didn't put your toe down and expect to catch up in the next 5 minutes. So, again, if there was a air attack, we're supposed to park up and do our air raid training, which I explained some reels ago. But that never happened. We always carried on. And we had four ACAC trucks, which were two Bren guns in parallel on the swivel seat. And these were manned by the buglers. It was one of their additional tasks. And they were interspersed through the convoy. And they were the ones that were supposed to do the air defence. But the range was about 1,000 yards, I think. 3,000 feet. Not much. Even in the early days of the war, it was all right in the 1418 war, where 3,000 feet was a good height. But, I mean, even the gladiators and those, the twin-winged planes were going beyond 3,000 feet. So, really, it was a bit of a waste of time. But, yes, this was a real training.
And what about stopping over distances, travelling with all the stoppages, stages? Did you have a kind of a routine in that matter? Did you stop, for example, like on a route march, 10 minutes every hour?
No. It was planned more or less in stages, in the planning stage, where it would stop. Because obviously, if you hit a town, you couldn't just stop with the vehicles, even if they were 120 yards apart. You couldn't stop in the town, otherwise you're going to stop the town. So, no, the staging was planned beforehand. And Peter Jeffries knew where he was going to stop before we set off.
And in the stage situation, all the vehicles would draw together again?
No.
You still kept the distance?
Well, we'd try to stage where they would close up slightly, but never bunched, no. Not even when they were parked. I was still alive there because we did have a place in Emmerin where they were parked on the village square. And there they were fairly close. But normally, they were always staged under trees, in a wood, anywhere. Very often some distance from wherever the billets were. So they weren't.
And what about embussing, getting on and getting off, debussing?
That was training. That was all done. It must have started in Franey, that, where the embussing and the debussing was carried out, where you had to sort of get one block onto the lorry and the other one pull the rest in.
And it was done in a speed, time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes.
And the same getting.
And done to the whistle. They were paraded, and then there'd be a whistle, and they would march off to the back of the truck and then clamber in as fast as they could. Yes, that was all part of the training.
And when you pulled up at your training objective, what was the routine then for getting men off?
Well, when we got towards the objective, that's when the DRs came into force, and they would be dispatched to the various companies, and by that time the CO or the commander, in this case very often Major Jeffries, although on occasions the CO did travel just behind us with his DRs just behind him, but Major Jeffries very often was in charge of the situation all the way through, and he would send his DRs off and he would tell them the message to the CO what direction you've got to take from a point. And the regimental police will be dropped off to direct the various columns, smaller columns, company columns, there where they could park and all the rest of it. So by the time we got to wherever we wanted to be, the column, in fact, had dropped down considerably. And then once we were debussed, the RAC, they went off and had their own little parking place Generally, the platoon would park up somewhere and find a wood or something.
Did you, as Major Jeffrey's driver, did you know in advance where you were going, or was he telling you as you were going along? Or did you plan it?
No, it was all planned by brigade transport. Brigade tool is where we were going on these sort of trips. And it was all routed. And on one occasion, I can't just remember where it was, but Major Jeffrey's missed a turning. And I still don't know how we did it. We went on the next turning, turned right and left, and right and left again. We finished up where we should have been. Now, what do you think? That he's got 120 miles of vehicles behind him. You know, he can't sort of just turn around and go back and join the... Because he got then he'd be behind the vehicles in front and he could have a trip with some of them. But he didn't. He took us out and round the country and back again and no bother at all. Then I was allowed to speed up a little bit. He dropped his DR off and told it to hold the transport where it was till we got back to a reasonable position. But we couldn't... go around in a circle and come back out again to where I want to be. Otherwise, we're going to be mixed up with all the transports going to be going around in a circle. Not Peter. He solved it all right. He just in and out the roads and back to where we should have been. So by the time we got to Tarouve, this was working fairly well, and Tarouve was a lovely village. I think probably one of the sweetest villages in France. We're billeted in the Mairie, which was the town hall. And there we did forest training. A big forest just outside of Tarouve. A wonderful place. And they used to set off out into this forest. And it was like the spokes of a wheel. You got in the centre of the forest, and the roads just went out. There were fire breaks, and the roads just went out, just like the spokes of a wheel. So it had to be a compass job, because they all looked the same. And, you know, without a compass, you were more or less baffled. I mean, you could see where the road break, where the gaps were. You could see through the trees. But apart from that, you had no idea of direction at all. And it was a really wonderful place, and they used to set the lads off hiking through the forest. And we'd spend half the night looking for them. But a little aside to the Tarouve, my vehicle was parked just outside the chemist's shop. And a lovely little girl in there, I suppose she was 17, 18. And we used to go for a walk and we'd sing to each other in French. Well, Sous de la Bore was a popular one at the time, or south of the border. That's a lovely girl. Very strict.
How long were you at
Tarouve? We were there about 10 days.
And what time of the year was this, can you recall?
We're working into mid-February, and the weather was just changing. Now, this is another point, nothing to do with the army at all, really. But in life, as you go through, you hit a weather situation which reminds you of a place. Now, a spring day, sort of a nice April spring day in this country, always takes me back to Tarouve. It's peculiar. And I mean, there are other things that crop up, like you hit a dust storm and you think about Kwasassan and Cairo and these sort of places where you couldn't see a thing for dust. But in life, I've noticed quite a lot that the weather situation seems to jog a memory much more than a lot of other things do. And today, Tarouve often comes back to me on a nice spring day, and because we did the weather changed much sharper than it does here. The weather changed there quite considerably. It was really lovely.
And were you built as comfortable in Tarouve?
In Tarouve, yes. We're on the floor, sleeping on the floor of the town hall. Sort of the dance hall affair in the town hall. Another aside to this is that Some of the boys went out for the night, and they got on the Creme de Menthe. And one of them came back, big hilly, he was a big lad, and he had the DTs. And those seven, I was trying to hold him down. And I had all of a foot, and all grabbed down, just trying to quieten him. And he let go with the foot, and I went through the plate glass door. Oh, we didn't have that. You know, the strength these people get when they... I don't say he had DTs, but he was berserk.
Was there a problem with drunkenness at all?
Not really. This was something he hadn't been used to. None of us had. I suppose I was fortunate that I could only take so much. And I was... having said that, I used to go and get it up and then come back for some more, didn't I? But,
what about the people of the village? Were they?
They were lovely. Lovely. Peter was in... well, we call him Peter because I call him Peter now. But, Major Jeffries was in a farm just outside the village. And I was in the town hall. And the people where he was billeted, they were really lovely.
So you slept in the town hall, and then you'd have to go up to him on the morning?
To him in the morning and get his shaving gear out, his, make him a cup of tea, which the people always allowed. Wherever we went, we were allowed to make tea. I had a cup of coffee, get his clothing out, ready for the day, and he would tell me what we were going to do, because he'd probably discuss it with the CEO the night before, and he would tell me what time he went to the vehicle and where we were going and what I had to do. As I said, he looked after himself very well, and I was mainly driving. And I used to do a lot on my own. You know, he'd send me off doing jobs on my own, especially for the naffy and things like that. But he was very good, very good, a brilliant man. So I really enjoyed Truro, the 10 days we were there. And from there we went to Molinver Dam. Again, this was a motorised division exercise, and this one was a shade longer, if I remember rightly. It was about 240 miles. So that was really the getting to grips with motorised transport. Can't remember much about Molinver Dam, except for a massive cemetery. The first time I'd really noticed the massive gravestones of a typical French cemetery. A massive place it was. Again, we did some forest training, because there's quite a lot of Francis forest, and the one at Truro was about 10 miles across. And it was, as I said, it was had these spokes in, and then there was two or three circular routes went through, went round. Massive places. They were really big forests. But I don't remember a lot about Molinver Dam. I can't even remember where I was billeted there.
What state were the French roads that you're driving over?
The main roads were quite good and straight. One in particular, which I did later on from Emron to Poy, that was dead straight with trees on either side. And that was a beautiful ride. Not very wide, just room for two cars to pass, and this was the main road. But most of the roads, hard clay, gravel, no hedges, very few hedges at all. Ditch either side, probably, of the road. And that's as much as you can say. It was shingle or gravel and hard clay.
Where did you move to from Molinver Dam?
Molinver Dam, we went straight to Emlyn, which was another good trip. 138 miles or somewhere about there, 140 miles. Amarin is 6 miles from Lille.
Do you recall when you got there?
Well, 29th of March. So we're about a month from arriving in Amarin. It took us nearly 2 months to get from Franey to Amarin. But we're doing training in between. It wasn't all travel. We're doing a training, divisional training, and all sorts of things in between.
Did you find any change between the types of French person as you were going through France towards the Belgian frontier?
Well, Amarin people, they really took to us because they had been through it all before. And no doubt, if I'd had the pens of mine, my father would probably have been in the same place. But he don't think of these things at the time. I know he'd been quite close to it in any case, but whether he was actually in Amarin or not, he never said. And I don't think I ever really told him that I was in Amarin. I told him I was close to Lille, but I don't think I ever told him I was in in Amarin.
And what was your billets and your accommodation like
there? There we had good billets. We were in a cafe. A big room on top of a cafe. Which surprised me, really, that it was like a dance hall on top of a cafe. And I didn't really expect villages in France to have these, but I assume that's what they were. They were like the one in Tourouve, was probably a dance hall in the Mairie. And the one in Amarin was the same. And the vehicles were parked in the square, in the village square. Cafes all the way around, and plenty of pubs all the way around. And we used to have a church parade on a Sunday. It was still church parades then. Unfortunately, I didn't get to many because I was away collecting naffy on most Sundays. It was the only day I could get away with training all through the week. It was really the only day I could get away for, collect naffy, to go any distance for naffy anyway. And the naffies, there were few and sparse. And they were sort of bulk naffies rather than a naffy where you're going for a cup of tea. They were bulk. And you had to have your order made out before you went down, and you went in, you bought the bulk, loaded it up, and back again.
So the quartermaster gave you an order, did he?
Major Jeffries gave me an order.
And this is through the funds that he had?
Yes. But you see, with the naffy stuff, that was brought back, handed over to the party, it was sold. It wasn't given, it was sold. Like razor blades, toothbrushes, toothpaste. All this sort of stuff, weren't they? It was all naffy, you see. It was all PRI. There was no army issue of razor blades or anything like that. Later on, there was issues of cigarettes in Egypt. Anyway, there was issues of cigarettes, but none at this stage. And we had to collect this stuff, and then it was sold over again. I had a nice little fiddle going for myself, because if the lads got hard up, they'd come to me with the postal orders and all the rest of it, and I would cash them, and then I'd go to the bank and cash them rather than taking the naffy, which it didn't amount to much, true enough, and the lads were glad because it meant they could have it that night rather than have to wait maybe till the Sunday till I cashed it with the naffy for them. So it worked out pretty well, that one.
What was the pay like, Mr. Iston? What kind of pay were you getting?
14 shillings a week. And in order that Mum could have a pension if anything did happen to me, I sent 3 and 6 months home, so I had 10 and 6 months a week.
And was that enough? Did it cover you?
Well, it's never enough, is it? But yes, it used to. You know, the parents used to often send us a few bob or something like that, or very often a biscuit tin full of cakes and things. We used to look for the biscuit tin coming through.
You were getting parcels from home?
Parcels from home, yes.
And were these pretty frequent?
I would say about once a month they came through anyway, yes.
And what about letters? Were you able to get those?
Letters, away? They were coming through fairly well, yes. I can't give you times, but I think we've got to do every most days of mail. Until the flap started, of course. Once the flap started, we got nothing. The parcels, they probably all went astray, the parcels.
Were your letters being censored at this time?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I can't say, but I don't think so. There were later. On the desert, they were all censored. Because, I mean, from the desert, they could have gone anywhere. But, no, I don't think it was censored at this stage.
What were the kind of grumbles that the troops tended to have in France before the actual outbreak of hostilities? Was there any grumble which was continuous?
There was a grumble that there was the phony war and nothing was happening. And we all knew we were digging these defences, and we all knew that if the flaps started, we were going to leave them. And there's a lot of grumble about that, because we knew that once we moved out, we were going to stretch ourselves. I'm saying everybody knew. It's possible that I knew, and I'll take me for what I had learned or what I understood. No, there was grumbles. There were definitely grumbles about this. And those grumbles were about the phony war, that we were in France and we weren't doing anything. We'd all gone to fight. We didn't want to fight, but we'd all gone to fight. And we could see that things were happening. I mean, Poland was still going on. Well, we knew what was going to happen. We knew exactly what was going to happen. We knew we were going to attack Belgium. There was no other way he had to attack Belgium.
Was there any boredom at this time?
Oh, no. 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 The lads got so much time off. Some nights, anyway, they got time off. And I used to do all my own repairs on my vehicle. And the fitter sergeant and fitter sergeant and some of his fitters and a few sergeants came up and they wanted to lift him to Lille. So I finally got round to brass tacks and I took him into Lille. However, the transport sergeant hadn't been invited on this trip, so he took exception to this and he reported me for taking a vehicle without leave. And a transport charge automatically goes to the commanding officer. It's dealt with by the company officer, but he can't do anything about it. It's got to go automatic to the commanding officer. So I was marching to the company office, and the officer commanding said he couldn't do anything about it. He'd have to go to the CO, so I was taken down to the battalion headquarters, 2:15 in the afternoon, all dolled up, and marched in, ran in, and explained the case, and it was dismissed. But I was very fortunate. I mean, I had taken the vehicle to take the lads in, but a few of the sergeants had stuck up. Now, whether Peter ever knew about this, whether Major Jeffries ever knew or not, I never told him. I never told him anything like that. But whether he knew or needed that, it squashed or not, I don't know. Anyway, the case was dismissed, and I got away with that one.
What were your relationships and those of the other men with your officers? Were there mutual respect? Was there any officer who didn't come up to your liking at all? It was difficult to get on with?
At this stage, I think we all had respect for the officers. They were TA people. They were local people, as far as we were concerned. There was the odd one and the odd things that we didn't like. I can't recall any at the moment, but at this stage, where we had our own regimental officers, I think we had a fair respect. We knew it was a uniform we saluted. It wasn't the man we saluted, it was the uniform. As I explained earlier, that some of the officers had been to school with me. We had a respect for the officers, I think. No, I don't think there was any real... Oh, those cribs, there's obvious cribs, day-to-day cribs, but in general terms, I don't think there was any real badness anywhere.
Did you feel that your training was bringing you up to a pitch where you could face the Germans? Did you feel happy with the kind of way you were developing over these days and months?
There was always this thing that we were still training more or less for trench warfare, and we knew that that wasn't happening. I think the junior officers sort of realised that this, when I say junior officers, I would say battalion commander stage, I think they realised that we were into something different to trench warfare. And they did try to training up to a different pitch. But the first tanks I saw was at the Battle of Arras. There was no tanks, we didn't end tank training, not like we did on the desert where we sort of jumped on the back of tanks and rode into battle. There was none of that in the first tanks we saw. And by all accounts, the tank commanders weren't a great deal better.